It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Supreme Court primary is next week. We'll learn more about what the justices actually do besides ruling on high-profile cases. First, state lawmakers in Tennessee and North Dakota have recently been setting examples for several other Republican-led legislatures introducing bills that seek to limit drag performances. In some cases, bills would criminalize performing in drag on public property, in public spaces, or in any location where they could be seen by a minor. In other cases, clubs and performance venues that host drag performances could be regulated like strip clubs. Well, no, Wisconsin lawmakers have come forward with similar bills. Madison East High School's Gender and Sexuality Alliance Group had planned to hold its first drag show in January, billing it as family-friendly. School officials postponed that event due to safety concerns after hostile posts online. Former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker tweeted in response to the event's announcement, quote, "Let's be clear, drag shows are strip shows. They are wrong. They're particularly wrong at school. They are definitely not family friendly," end quote. PolitiFact rated that statement as false. We're going to talk about some of the long history of drag performances and the backlash against them, past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of drag performances? Have you attended or participated in events like these? Did you see ones that were family friendly, others that were less so? Do you want to see regulations different than they are now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Finn Enke is professor of history and gender and women's studies at UW-Madison and director of the undergraduate LGBTQ plus studies certificate program at UW-Madison. Finn, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start off with a basic working definition of what we mean when we say drag?
Sure. Drag, it's actually a term that's derived from ancient Greek theater, so it goes back a very long way. The Greek word means masquerade. And the roots of drag have really remained in theatrical performances, generally involving cross-dressing, which itself is an ancient theater practice, and not only in Western culture, but actually most of the world. We see it in many Asian cultural contexts as well. And to a large extent, theater itself is really unimaginable without the history of actors playing a variety of gender roles. And that's what was typically associated with that term drag. There have always been many different kinds of drags and many different contexts for drag performances, including drag balls that are community performance events, theater, and so forth. And some of it really is probably as old as human history.
One more historical stop. If I know my history correctly here, in Shakespeare's day, women weren't allowed in most cases to be actors, and there are a lot of women's roles in Shakespeare. So theoretically, there were a lot of, I guess, drag performances on the stage then.
Yes, absolutely. It's integral to Shakespearean theater. We can't imagine Shakespearean theater without it. But in fact, it goes back farther than that. And any theater context that begins with the premise of gender of actors in a specific gender generally involve that. So Japanese theater traditions are very strongly associated also with all female theaters and all male theaters that involve a great deal of cross-dressing and cross-gender performance.
Now, you mentioned drag balls. What other kinds of performances are really, I guess, drag-centric as opposed to, you know, a theatrical performance that might feature people performing different gender roles? If that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a great question. The drag balls I was referring to specifically in North America, queer drag shows, and they even were called drag balls, have existed at least since the 19th century. And they are generally community events. They involve performative dancing. They involve, of course, cross-dressing. And the emphasis primarily has been on community building and creating a space for community performance, for creative expression, and for really just highlighting the creative brilliance of queer culture. And, you know, most importantly, I think providing a space for that to grow and flourish.
Talking to Finn Enke, professor of history, gender, and women's studies at UW-Madison, looking at some of the history behind drag performances, the ups and downs, sometimes backlash against them, past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with a personal experience you might like to share, a question, 800-642-1234. Last summer on Central Time, I talked to author Michael Takash about the history of drag in Wisconsin in particular. Here's a little of Michael talking about drag being considered family-friendly about a century ago.
By 1910, you know, the rise of national drag celebrities like Burt Savoy and Carl Norman and Julian L. Teange really changed, like, the whole concept of female impersonation. I mean, it was completely family-friendly to go to an Orpheum vaudeville show with your, you know, your grandmother in the 19-teens and 1920s, simply because everyone knew it was a man pretending to be a woman, and the joke was, you know, not on the audience. There was no deception. There was no depravity.
And that was part of a story where drag kind of went in and out of fashion and went in and out of public approval. Why do you think that it's gone through different eras, Finn, where at some point it might be fun for the whole family and in some cases targeted by others and even shut down?
I think these things often go in waves, commonly in association with political election cycles. These things track. So when you see the emergence of specifically transphobic or homophobic legislation set or increased stigma around community events that do involve an element of queerness, these are often associated with political campaigns, with shoring up an idea of what should be normative, what shouldn't be normative. But in fact, these things have persisted throughout those times, and it's impossible to get rid of it because human life is about performance and play and imagination. We dress up, we adorn ourselves, we impersonate animals, we impersonate other humans, we engage in masquerade. It's so much the fabric and creative expression of human life and of storytelling. And I think that's what draws people to spaces that may be queer spaces. They may not be queer spaces, but without necessarily even thinking, oh, this is a queer event. This is a theater event. It's about storytelling. It's about you know, this kind of creative brilliance. And we see the persistent popularity of these types of events in many different arenas, many, many different arenas.
As I mentioned at the outset, some of the states looking at legislation would regulate venues that host drag shows on a par with strip clubs. We heard from former Governor Walker. I quoted his online statement saying that drag shows are strip shows. I guess compare and contrast for us.
So there's two ways to approach this. And one is that Walker is implying in his comment that strip shows are bad and drag shows are like strip shows and therefore are bad and unwholesome. And I think that's highly problematic for many different reasons. One, drag is not strip, and I'll come back to that in a second, but I think that we should not be lured into thinking that we should defend drag on the grounds that it's not strip any more than you would have to defend Shakespeare by saying it's not a strip show. The power of that, not only to further stigmatize strip shows, you know, which is something I'm not really willing to go there, to throw strip shows under the bus in the effort to, you know, make drag something else. But also, in fact, the comparison is intended to be very homophobic, it's intended to be transphobic, and its greatest power is that any engagement with that comparison, even to refute the claim, legitimates the comparison as one worthy of debate. So we spend a lot of our airtime saying, well, is it or isn't it? Is it or isn't it? Instead of learning about queer culture on its own terms, we don't have an opportunity to learn about queer culture on its own terms because we're sitting here talking about whether, you know, whether strip shows and drag shows have things in common. And in fact, they're two different performance events with different purpose, with different context, you know, and a different set of possibilities within each genre.
We're talking to Finn Enke, professor of history, gender, and women's studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about the historical nature of drag performances in the midst of several recent legislative efforts in states around the country to criminalize drag in certain spaces, or at least heavily regulate it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What do you want to know more about when it comes to the history and culture of performing in drag? Have you seen a drag performance yourself with your family or friends? What did it mean to you? Have you participated in them yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Finn Enke, professor of history and gender and women's studies at UW-Madison. Several Republican-led states are looking at criminalizing drag performances in certain spaces, and we're talking about the history and the culture of drag performances. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brandon is with us in Poinette. Brandon, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Brandon?
Well, I just tuned in, and it's strange because we just yesterday bought tickets to a drag show coming up in April in Madison, and we've never been. Me and my wife, my stepdaughter, and her boyfriend are planning on going. It's an 18-plus show, and just kind of curious what we're in for. I'm excited. I'm really excited to go. I've always wanted to see one.
Brandon, thanks for the call. Finn, I imagine there might be as many different answers as there are drag shows to that question, but what might you say to Brandon?
Well, I think that's exactly right. There are so many different kinds, and I'm very curious for Brandon about what drew you to the show.
Oh, that's a good question.
What made you still curious?
Are you still there, Brandon?
Yeah, I'm here. What was the question?
You mentioned you're excited to see the show. What was it that that caught your eye?
Well, it's a 80s, 90s music theme. That's cool. And I've just always heard they're a lot of fun. I've never heard anybody say anything bad about them. I've always heard everybody that I know that's been has had a blast. And I just think it's neat. And I'm excited to go.
Brandon, thanks for the call. And Finn, thanks for asking the question I should have asked.
It's a perfect opportunity because I think that Brandon's question, gosh, now I wonder what I'm in for, maybe is a result of somebody having made a comparison between drag and strip shows. Strip shows, their purpose usually to highlight tensions and desires around access to sexualized nudity. But drag shows, they're highlighting performative aspects of gender. It's play, it's fun, it's enhancement of the everyday work that goes into appearing in culture. And I think that's part of why they are so fun, because everybody, in fact, engages in this activity. We don't usually highlight it.
Brandon?
What it is to adorn ourselves, what it is to perform, even.
Brandon, thanks a lot for that call. I want to listen to Trixie Mattel, who joined the show back in 2021. That's the stage name of Brian Michael Furcus, a singer, actor, and drag queen who attended UW-Milwaukee. Trixie was the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Season 3. Here's Trixie talking about the wider appeal of drag, especially people in the cisgender community.
They've always liked drag. They just didn't always call it drag. So if you think of, like, the movie White Chicks, or if you think of Madea, or Mrs. Doubtfire, it's like, well, that all is drag. We just didn't really call it drag. But what's great is people are more and more accepting all the time. And when you become open-minded, you become accepting of things you didn't know about, and you find new things you like. I mean, that's just, like, universal. And I think that in America especially, we're so afraid of sex and gender, and drag throws a nuclear bomb and all of that. So when you enjoy drag and you go, oh, I thought this was going to be something at its core. Drag is really just like, you know, it's your Halloween closet. You're playing dress up and lip syncing for your friends.
So the view from at least one drag performer there, Finn, what do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I think I couldn't say it better myself.
We are talking to Finn Enke, professor of history and gender and women's studies at UW-Madison, looking at the history and culture of drag performances. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Finn, a lot of the criticism and the threatening protests surrounding drag performances at least make the claim that it's about protecting children from seeing something, I guess, they ought not to see. What do you think of those arguments from some of the critics and some of the lawmakers trying to restrict drag performances?
Well, again, it's the oldest sort of tried and true political tactic on the books to claim that we need to protect children. In fact, children are themselves extremely creative people and are also engaging in figuring out what different ways they want to express themselves. And I think that giving children an opportunity to explore that is a very healthy thing. I would never want to raise a child without the opportunity to explore how they, you know, enjoy presenting themselves in the world. And I think the other issue is that every drag show has its intended audience, and its show is geared toward that audience. If it doesn't reach that audience, it's not a successful performance. And so performances that are, for example, they have the storytelling hours and things like that, that are really are pitched for young people at public libraries and this sort of context, they have children in mind, right? So they are children friendly. I think that the legislation suggests that children shouldn't ever dress up. Well, tell them that on Halloween. Children shouldn't ever be in theater and act as another being or another kind of human. Well, so should they not be in theater? Should they not even sing? Because much of singing is theatrical performance, right? So we're always taking on a role that is expressive, and drag shows for any audience is designed for that audience to think about the possibilities for human expression and the ways that we can play with that in everyday life as well as in performance contexts.
Let's bring on another caller. Julie is with us in Sister Bay. Julie, hi.
Hi, how are you today? I just wanted to mention I was on the school board a few years back, and I understand the conservative measures that a school board has to take as far as the drag shows in the schools. I would be all for it, but I think there's just not enough education, and when you're dealing with so many parents and so many students, it would be just a tough thing. But I wanted to say that my husband and I had attended a drag show 25 years ago at the Dinosaur Theater in Las Vegas. We did not know what to expect, and to this day, it is probably still the most fun thing that we ever attended. The talent was unreal. The singing, it was just beautiful, and we still talk about it to this day.
Julie, thanks a lot for that call. Julie personally enjoyed that drag show, but understands why school boards might be cautious about allowing, say, that thing we heard about at Madison East. What would you say to, you know, people serving on a school board or community members who are considering, you know, a student group hosting a drag show on the school campus?
Well, I think they need to educate themselves about what people are actually doing. And I think if they're going to ask about that they should be asking, you know, about any of the contexts that kids are in. To be honest, the performances of transphobia and homophobia, these are performances we experience day in and day out. Those don't tend to get recognized as performative. They don't tend to get recognized as something that we should be concerned about, though they're directly targeting trans and non-binary and genderqueer and gay and lesbian bisexual kids. So So I do think there is an issue there with how do you protect all the members of a school and invite everybody into their creative vitality as human beings? And if we can ask that question first, without engaging in homophobic and transphobic and damaging sorts of stigmatizing discourse and behavior, then that's a question that's important to ask. How do we protect and how do we encourage and how do we allow all of the members of our community to flourish as themselves and to explore new things? And it is often a community conversation.
Julie, thanks for that call. And Finn, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Finn Enke is professor of history and gender and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We've been talking about the history and culture of drag performances. This as several Republican-led states are looking at proposals to either criminalize performing in drag in certain spaces or offer new restrictions to venues that that host drag performances. Coming up after the news, find out what state Supreme Court justices actually do besides ruling on cases as voters head to the polls next week for the primary election. And you can get us started right now. Is there something you are curious about as to what the state Supreme Court does and why we elect justices in the first place? You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And you can head over to WPR.org for interviews with most of the candidates in that primary and a lot of news coverage of the campaign so far. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, with the rising popularity of esports and online gaming, we'll find out why UW La Crosse created a video game recreation center for students on campus. Now, the primary election for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court is a week from tomorrow. Voters will be narrowing down the candidates for a hotly contested race drawing national headlines. It's a really important role in Wisconsin state government, but what do the justices actually do? We know they issue rulings on high-profile cases, but what are they doing the rest of the time? Turns out the justices serve a variety of important administrative and regulatory roles in the state as well. We're going to take a crash course on the state Supreme Court leading up to this big election, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what the state Supreme Court does and does not do? Are there any misconceptions you want cleared up? Have you dealt with the court system going all the way up to the state Supreme Court in one capacity or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He specializes in public law, judicial process, and American politics. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you lay out the basics of the, you know, the constitutional role that that the state Supreme Court is supposed to have?
Well, in very basic sort of elementary school civics kind of approach, you know, we have three branches of government. And as most of us learn, there are separated powers that are checked. And so we have a legislative branch, which is responsible for drafting laws. We have an executive, which is tasked with implementing or executing those laws. And the role of the courts in its most basic form is we want them to interpret the laws and apply them fairly, hopefully to achieve some sort of justice as we're going to define that as a society. But as you noted in your introduction, all courts have a role that goes much beyond merely interpreting law because they help to manage our system of justice in myriad ways.
Before we get into the tasks of the Supreme Court, the elections for the Supreme Court, each state does things differently. Some elect, some don't. some other states, you run as a Democrat or a Republican or whatever. In Wisconsin, it is, at least in theory, nonpartisan. Could you tell us what makes our system of judge selection, I guess not fully unique, but stand out to you?
Well, one of the interesting things to me is if you look at the history of the constitutional development in this state, there was quite a bit of debate about exactly how judges were going to be selected in the state. And up until the ratification of our constitution in the state, there was a movement, rather slow and incremental, to add the election of judges because most eastern states that founded the country were using some sort of appointive process, either through a governor or through a legislature. And there's a great line in one of the debates about our constitution where the argument was we should elect because we should rely on the genius of the people in order to pick the judges, that we were capable of making a decision about who would be competent to sit on the bench, both at the trial level as well as at the appellate level, hearing appeals from the lower courts. We are not unique because we do elect. Every state in the union elects at least at one level of the courts. And boy, there are about as many variations in elections and selection as there are states. But there has been a movement away from election towards what are called merit systems. And merit systems, again, vary widely as well. But the idea is you try to create a list of qualified individuals, and that can be described in a number of ways as well. And from that, the governor may select someone or the legislature may select somebody. And then at some point you face what's called a retention election, where if you've done a good job, you run by yourself on the ballot. And in sort of some sort of Roman emperor fashion, the public gets to give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down on the job that you've done.
Let's get into the job itself now. The headlines, when there's a high profile case, redistricting, ruling on a challenge to an election result, abortion, then we see the state Supreme Court cases in the news. Can you talk about the range of things as far as caseload that finds its way to the state Supreme Court?
Yeah, so I think what surprises a lot of people is how few cases wind up at either a state or the federal Supreme Court. It is an incredibly small fraction of the cases that come before courts in the state. So, you know, in a typical year, we'll have almost, well, 700,000 or so cases run through the court. And remember, a lot of those are rather minor misdemeanor criminal cases, traffic cases, and the like. But the court will routinely only take and decide fewer than 100 cases in a given year. And what's also, I think, surprising to individuals is the greatest number are civil cases, not criminal cases. When we think courts, we almost always get sort of sucked into our reliance on television and mass media to portray courts as the sort of final decision maker in all of these criminal cases. But so much more of the law is resolving civil disputes, things as commonplace as a divorce, but also you know, issues relating to product liability or traffic accidents, those kinds of issues. And those very technical civil cases are often the ones that the court is dealing with most of all, rather than, you know, some of the more prominent cases involving notorious criminal matters.
What is it that makes the state Supreme Court say, yes, we're going to take this case? What are some of the guidelines that they use to say this is something that should be handled at this court of this highest court in the state?
Well, it's funny because no court really has, no Supreme Court has a real well-defined list of you must take a certain number of cases or types of cases. Most state Supreme Courts and the federal Supreme Court hear the vast majority of their cases through what's called a discretionary docket. Docket's a fancy way of just saying a list of cases. And so they have discretion to pick and choose the cases that they think are important to hear. And for the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin, the standard is really kind of wide open. You know, they look to or look for cases that are going to trigger what they consider their institutional responsibility to try and decide complicated or serious and significant cases. And it takes three of the seven justices to provide an avenue for your case to come to the court. And that might seem, well, geez, that's not even a majority. But part of that is because they want to make sure that public policy needs are met. So they want the threshold a little bit lower to take these kinds of cases. So it's really, in many respects, up to the whims and wishes of the justices themselves about what they deem to be important at any one time. It could be the political or ideological preference of the justices? What are some significant policy concerns of the state at that moment? It could be that there are several cases in one particular area or dealing with one particular legal question that demand the attention right now. So there are myriad reasons why the justices might take a case or not. It just often depends upon the economic, political, and social milieu of any particular age.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College, looking at the role of Wisconsin's Supreme Court. A seat on that court is open. Primary election day is a week from tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about Wisconsin's Supreme Court, what it does, why it does it the way that it does? And when you as a voter are asked to pick a state Supreme Court justice, how do you do it? What do you weigh? What are the factors that go into deciding who you vote for? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charlie, in talking to most of the candidates over the last week or so, some of them point toward the other things that justices do apart from hearing cases. They're sort of the bosses of the court system in general in Wisconsin. Can you talk about that part of the gig?
Sure. I think one of the most important roles they play is in their administrative supervisory role, because the Supreme Court, since they sit atop the court system, they're responsible for helping to guide the legislature through the governor's budget toward proper budgeting of the entire system. And as a result, they are always trying to push for more support for judges, more support for staffing, and a variety of resources that are necessary in the system itself. It's always a struggle in the court system, especially on the criminal side, to get adequate funding, because the public isn't always interested in spending their tax dollars to, as an example, sort of help or aid in the processing of criminal cases, because it doesn't seem necessarily worthy of the expenditure of our tax dollars. So, you know, they have significant input into what the budget request will be, although they don't always receive the appropriations that they really desire. Another thing that they really have to do is look to the long term. I mean, one of the things about courts is they're constantly processing cases, and so everything is immediate. Cases come in, they have to be handled in some way and expeditiously move through the system to a resolution. But they have to think long term about what the court is going to be dealing with in a year, in 5 years, in 20 years. So just as an example, one of the big issues that's facing courts today has to do with elder law. You know, you think about the baby boomers who are retiring, and that has certain pressures on certain elements of our system, like Social Security. But think about all of the care that they're going to need and the possibility of fraud and corruption with individuals who might have their resources stolen. They might get improper care from caretakers. And so we have this sort of pig coming through the python with all these individuals who are going to need special attention from the courts. So the courts really have to look in the long term to these kinds of things.
We're talking to St. Norbert College political science professor Charlie Jacobs about the role of Wisconsin State Supreme Court justices ahead of next week's primary election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you know enough about what the state Supreme Court does to cast a vote in that primary election next week? When you are deciding who to vote for, what do you look toward? Do you try to weigh their judicial philosophy? Do you look at how they might be expected to rule on particular issues, the endorsements that come along the way? Call on with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He's helping us learn more about what the state Supreme Court does as we run closer and closer to the election day in the state Supreme Court primary for an open seat, a pivotal seat. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the state Supreme Court? Do you worry about the partisan lean of the court one way or another? How should voters evaluate justices? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Oshkosh. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just calling in to say, I think right now anyway, and probably most times, it's a myth about the nonpartisan nature of our judges. I mean, it's almost funny to suggest that being true, because clearly right now I see it all about the abortion issue that's pending. At the state Supreme Court will eventually decide the abortion issue from the dominating Republican legislature. And the conservative ones running will support the 1850 rule law. You could even call it that.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And Charlie, a lot of people have observed that, yes, they don't run with an R or a D next to their name on the ballot. But Mark says it's a myth that they're nonpartisan. What do you think?
I think there's a lot of evidence that the public agrees with Mark. We are seeing at the national level the legitimacy of the United States Supreme Court slip because they are perceived as wholly partisan on their face in the way in which their decisions are made. And the same kinds of issues are bleeding into state Supreme Court races and local judicial races as well. And in fact, it preceded some, I think, of the lost legitimacy at the national level. If you look at some of the races that preceded this year's, with the exception of one or two in the last 20 years, the amount of money that has poured in from outside actors, those outside of the state of Wisconsin or disconnected from direct participation in the race, the money has just been creeping up and up and up. And it's because the expectation is if the right candidate wins, whichever side you're on, you're going to get the kind of decisions that you want, that there is no unbiased court system. It has always been rife with this kind of partisanship. And, you know, we went to a nonpartisan system in the 1890s, and we did in part because the progressive movement was really worried about the perception of partisanship in elections for courts. But the thing is that by calling it a nonpartisan election doesn't make it a nonpartisan election. To me, one of the most farcical is the state of Ohio, where you run in a primary under a partisan banner, but then miraculously it's a nonpartisan general election, as though you transform like a butterfly or something and all of a sudden don't have any ideological perceptions at all. So I think most of the public understands what's going on here, and they look for cues to help them in making their selection, whether a person is liberal or conservative, and what that might signal in the outcome of races. So Mark, I think, is on the right track. We have lots of data in political science that shows this.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. A lot of times candidates will say or tell me on the show, Charlie, don't vote for a judge because you think they'll give them the outcome you want on a particular policy item that may come before them. Easier said than done. Like, how do you pick a judge if you take out the policy outcomes?
Well, it begs a question. What's a good judge? Mm-hmm. And I don't have an answer. I mean, you have to ask, how are we going to measure whether or not the output of a particular judge is appropriate and correct? How are we going to define a just outcome? And in particular, if we're talking about rather arcane legal matters that most of the public doesn't understand, it's hard to understand whether or not the outcome was right, just, correct, or fair. And so that's why the cues are so important. That's why we look for the signals that we look for, because we can, as an individual with our own personal biases, try to determine what we think just outcomes would be. And that often has an ideological or partisan valence. That's the problem with this. I wish it were something else. And you know, I've talked with judges who I think bristle when I tell them about the data that we have, but we have really good long-term longitudinal data that shows us, even though judges will protest and say, I am not ideological, their voting pattern shows it very, very clearly.
Right. We see, I think this in a U.S. Supreme Court nomination proceedings, the argument that I'm a judge who will call balls and strikes. I'm an umpire. You know, I'm not rooting for one team or another in the case. Like, hypothetically, couldn't we have a judge like that?
Well, hypothetically, yes. And quite honestly, your example is a good one because it's Justice Roberts. And while, you know, the data we have about him also shows a slight ideological lilt, I think that there was a certain amount of sincerity in the way he positioned himself, because the way he has tried to use his position as Chief Justice is to narrow the issues, try to answer as little as humanly possible in a decision so that it did not appear, even though it might be ideological, it didn't look ideological to the casual observer. And I think he has become very frustrated with the court. You can see it in some of the opinions he writes with the way in which his colleagues on the bench have operated. And we've seen in Wisconsin the same kind of little battles erupt. we take the shift from the most senior justice being the chief justice to the change in about 2015, I think it was, to an elective position. Well, that was an internal partisan battle because the chief justice controls some of the machinations inside the court. So it's really hard for the public, I think, to disconnect from what they're perceiving and trying to determine whether or not that is actually the opposite of this kind of ideological positioning that we see. And it doesn't help when we get national organizations coming in and making all of these radical claims, both about liberals and conservatives who are running for the court, because they are injecting that kind of partisanship in the debate. And it really is a struggle for the public to make what they might perceive as the unbiased choice for an unbiased justice.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political scientist at St. Norbert College, about the role of the state Supreme Court. Charlie, when I talk to candidates for the court, I always ask about their collegiality, which feels in some ways like a dumb question. You'd assume that judges at that level would be able to play nice with each other. And yet, we had an incident in Wisconsin where one judge put his hands on the neck of another judge. Some observers described choking. Others said fleeting contact. I mean, it's not always real pretty in Wisconsin State Supreme Court.
No, and it's not pretty in a lot of courts around the country as well, because when you're talking about a state court, you have a much more homogeneous population. And because of that, also, you often have narrower issues that bring the focus to the public and the court and its justices more narrowly focused. And because of that, I think the stakes seem a lot higher. And I'm not saying that the United States Supreme Court doesn't have the same kind of stakes, but because we have a diffuse population, it affects people in different ways. And collegiality is very important. When you hear about the United States Supreme Court, I think that's one of the things that heartens people, is that someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia, who were about as opposite in their ideological positions on the court, would routinely go out for pizza and then go to the opera. That makes you feel comfortable that they are trying very hard to work together. But when you hear these kinds of stories about the court, and part of it has to do with you have to get reelected, so that you have to continually position yourself on the bench to make sure that the public believes that you're performing in the way you promised you would and said you would when you were running as you're heading up for reelection. So the justices on the Supreme Court are freed from that because they have life tenure. So I think collegiality dissipates when you have to constantly run. And I know it's every 10 years, which is a long period of time, but you still have to run for re-election. You still have to convince the public of your abilities on the bench.
Charlie, I wanted to spend most of this interview not talking about the high-profile headline cases. Just in our last minute and a half or so, what are some of the big decisions you are watching for that this new justice being elected might be weighing in on?
Well, obviously, as Mark noted, there's the abortion decision, which is coming soon, that we're going to have to grapple with, and how Wisconsin is going to react to the Dobbs decision in relation to state cases. I think the other issue is still the issue of elections and the regulation of elections and the Elections Commission and everything surrounding it, because we're still grappling with sort of the fallout from a lot of changes that have happened over the years and the recent elections. So from the beginning of photo ID and that kind of validation you have to have when you go to the polls, and now issues related to drop boxes and counting and methods of balloting. So I think those are high priorities because they are so closely aligned with democratic principles and choice. So I think those are two that we're really going to watch for, sort of generally speaking, over the next couple of years.
Oh, and briefly, Charlie, what do we usually see when it comes to turnout in these statewide Supreme Court elections?
Terrible. The average is about 18%, and it may wander as high as about 25% of eligible voters, because nonpartisan elections, generally speaking, don't draw people to the polls. And we see in these sort of lower profile cases, and they're lower profile because a lot of people don't pay attention to the courts. They do what's called roll off. They might vote for somebody who is local in their community, but then not vote for others. So we've seen turnout as low as about 10 or 12% recently in high court races. So I would expect around 20% here.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Very welcome. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He specializes in public law, judicial process, and American politics. He's with us today to give us a primer on the roles and responsibilities of the state Supreme Court as primary election day is just over a week away. Tomorrow on the morning show with Kate Archer Kent, the world of dating has changed a lot over the years with the rising use of online dating apps. Whether you're part of it or you're not, learn about dating these days. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Think back to a prehistoric time when giant creatures walked the earth. And if we were there, we would tremble at the mighty footsteps of the giant penguin. As reported by Smithsonian Magazine, research published last week in the Journal of Paleontology describes fossils of a species of giant penguin from New Zealand over 50 million years ago. A little perspective first. Your modern penguin, depending on species, can weigh 2 pounds on up to almost 90 pounds for emperor penguins. 90 pounds is big, but you know what's bigger? 340 pounds. That's the estimated weight of one of the species described in the research. You can line them up as offensive tackles, except they spend most of their time in the water. Here's my movie pitch. In Ireland Park, where the extinct giant penguin species is reintroduced to the Earth, it's Jurassic Park meets the penguin movie. Hollywood producers, give me a call. This is Central Time.